From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Sometimes we stay stuck even when there's evidence that there's a newer, better version to try. Old habits die hard. Here's how one friend, today's guest, Matt Mattis, explained it in a recent social media post that caught my eye. He wrote, "It's hard to change, especially when a method becomes a nostalgic ritual." Indeed. Matt's here today to talk about some of our nostalgic rituals that we cling to and others we've surrendered in favor of new and improved versions. So more in a moment, but first, these messages.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
You may recall a popular conversation on the show about Christmas cactuses a few months back with today's return guest, Matt Mattis, who gardens in Massachusetts and is the author of various gardening books, including Mastering the Art of Vegetable Gardening and Mastering the Art of Flower Gardening. When Matt isn't tending his own ambitious garden and greenhouse or hosting open day tours, he also provides consultation services, both virtually and in person, to help others with garden design and plant care issues. Hi again, Matt. How are you?
I'm terrific, Margaret. How are you?
Okay. How are your nostalgic rituals?
Yeah. It seems like the older I get, every ritual is nostalgic.
Yeah. So as I alluded to in the introduction, you know, I read it was an Instagram post you did not long ago, and it was actually about forcing branches, you know, to bring them indoors for winter display or whatever, and how you do it now, and you were recalling how you used to do it by comparison, and it opened up that topic that you so beautifully call nostalgic rituals. So to set the scene, maybe tell us the then and now version of forcing, because that's one you've changed, I think, yes?
It has, yeah. Well, I was talking about branches, and beginning of January or through the month of January, especially up here in the north, right, Massachusetts, New York, it's cold and snowy and you want to force some branches. I think even as a kid, I don't know if you did this, but I would run out and cut forsythia, you know, that forces really quickly, or any flower, or sometimes even apple or crab apple or quince, and put them in bottles on the windowsill. You know, it's one of my earliest horticultural ventures at like, you know, 12, and watch them, see if they would bloom. But I would experiment and cut, you know, any shrub, lilac, even, you know, barberry, whatever I had in the garden at that time, and see if it would bloom. And you learn a lot that way. Some things just seem like they took forever, and some things seem to bloom in a week or two. And, you know, as you grow as a gardener, as I did, some of my very early gardening books my mom would buy me would be like a Thalassa Crusoe book, and she would talk about forcing branches. And I'd be like, oh, she's saying we should pound the ends with a hammer, and that would allow it to take up more water, or we should put warm water in the bottles, or there's just a lot of, you know, myths or truths, right?
And right, iterations of advice sort of along the way, right?
Right. And then through, you know, through high school, I went to an agricultural high school, so we would force trees and shrubs for the New England Flower Show in Boston, and that was exciting. And I learned that, wait, we're forcing some big branches and we're not pounding them. Like, is that right or wrong?
Right. It was like you took a hammer and like you shattered it, so it split, the lower portion split, as if that helped it to suck up more water. Yeah.
Yeah. It made sense. Right. Like, just logically, oh, I'm exposing more cells. But again, you're thinking maybe it's damaging more cells. And also in high school, I worked at a florist part time, and like, we never pounded the branches and they still would take up water. But, you know, 30, 40 years later, you read that, I'm still reading that people are saying to pound branches. And on the other hand, I'm starting to read research where people say, no, just cut at an angle, or cut an X in the bottom, or don't cut it, just cut it with sharp secateurs as soon as you bring it in the house and put it into warm water. And I've been doing that for 10 years now, and I never notice a difference. They all bloom the same time.
Yeah, it made me smile when I read that, that you'd gone from the pound, because I always, at that time of year, I keep a hammer by just inside the front door, the kitchen door, and right outside the kitchen door, I have like a big, what do you call those millstones? A big, huge stone millstone. I bought a pair of them that sort of flank the door. I bought them, a million years ago, and they're just these huge, and what stones. And I would bring the branches over to there, with things that I was cutting. And before I'd go in the house to put things in water, I would put my hammer just inside the door, and I'd pound everybody right on the millstone. So it was like that was my nostalgic ritual, is that was my spot, that I did the deed.
Exactly. And so, I mean, I used to work at a big florist in Boston, like through on part time in college, and you would get these huge bunches of flowering quince in from the flower market that flew in on a plane from the Netherlands, and they just had sharp cuts. They were never pounded. So you
Right.
start to question these things, like, yeah, maybe you're not really exposing any more cells. If anything, you're damaging more. And I
Right.
did research somewhere that said don't pound. I don't remember where it was, but that's when I stopped pounding. But I did kind of miss, that trudging out in the snow and cutting a branch, and I'm going to pound it a little and put the, even my dad, we would go pick pussy willows in end of February and put the big branches in the cellar. And maybe another myth, he always said we'd put them near the furnace in the dark because they would turn pink, which never really happened. They had a pinkish glow just because they were growing in the dark. We would pound the stems, and now I still do that. I still pick pussy willows and don't pound them.
So what are a couple of things that, I mean, early blooming things are usually especially good to force, like you were doing, I think you were doing witch hazel maybe in the Instagram post or something that you mentioned. Witch hazel, I can't remember what else you were doing. Oh, cornice moss, the chameleon cherry, right, which is a
So those are,
dogwood.
and we've had sort of really unpredictable, sort of irregular winters these past 2 or 3 winters. This is a colder winter, I guess, than normal, but it was a long, warm fall, right? And my witch hazel, and so for Hamamelis, there are a lot of crosses and hybrids. So I have Arnold's Promise, which is a spring blooming witch hazel. There are fall and midwinter blooming ones too, but this one typically would bloom in February, March, April even. But in November it was blooming.
Oh my.
This is the second year in a row it bloomed, not the whole tree, but 70% of it was in bloom. And
Oh my goodness.
I know, and it would get cold and the petals roll up again. And biologically they're designed that way. And so I knew it would force quickly. So I often would pick it the first week of January as my recovery from the holidays. The start, and it takes about a week and a half to come into full bloom. I mean, right now it's almost in shatter mode, when it blooms and then it scatters. But it comes into bloom very quickly. And cornice moss, if you're not familiar with it, the carnelian cherry is, it's a dogwood, but it doesn't look like a dogwood. It has a small yellow flower. It's like a dogwood that you pull the white petals off of, or the white bracts. But I think it's only good for forcing, personally. It's great. It's a great shrub, but I plant these out along the edge of the property with, other trees that you can force. I have this fantasy of putting in a cut flower garden that's just forcing shrubs. A row of quince, a row of basil, so you can hack them up and not cut your landscape shrubs. But they all come into bloom rather quickly this time of year in January and beginning of February. But the closer you get out, I mean, when you closer you get to spring, then you could start looking at the more difficult ones to
Like
force.
the or even just like the fruit trees, like if you have an apple or a crab apple, I mean those will do. Those will
Quince
do
is
it.
very quick. That's why you see it, posh New York hotels, you see huge quince branches. You can't have enough of that. That comes into bloom pretty quickly in the early winter. But by things like lilacs, and I had a lot of comments on my post about lilacs, where people said I always pound the stems on lilacs, or magnolia, and these aren't things you think you dream about forcing these, but it's rather unsuccessful, unless maybe you're in April or just before, 2 or 3 weeks
If it's
before
just before the bloom time, the normal bloom time,
and that's an easier time to force those.
So at the At the end of that Instagram post, you said something really beautiful, and I'm going to quote it because it's just a good. So, in other words, there was no disdain for either holding on to the nostalgic ritual or letting go and doing something different. And you said, "If it's your precious annual ritual, keep on doing it. No one needs to know. As with so many methods in gardening, it's all much more than knowing the perfect scientific way. Sometimes the soul needs tending too."
It
So,
does. Yeah, I think about this a lot because if you follow me online, I'm often, grumbling about cold, sowing poppies on the snow, or there's a lot of myths out there
well,
that,
that's another one, right?
but
Is
yeah, that's one that
as if
totally
we have to do
makes
it
sense.
then, right?
Right. And I went down that rabbit hole trying to find out how that sowing poppy seeds on the snow started. And I think it goes right back to England, to the Reverend who sort of discovered a pink poppy growing in a field of red Shirley poppies, Papaver rhoeas, in and it's there was a freak snowstorm that week. I looked it up on the weather. You can look up the weather of any day of the year in any
Oh.
town, and he had reported there was 4 inches of snow and the poppies were still alive. So I don't know if that's where it started in sort of the late Victorian era, but
Huh.
people. I think the original, I think a very early, like 1888, story in a horticultural magazine talked about my grandmother sowing seeds on the snow of poppies because it helped distribute the seed. So it
Right, and
fell thin.
that's what I always thought. I thought it was because, first of all, unlike on the soil, you could see the seed, how finely or thickly you were spreading it. It was like a nice palette for sprinkling your seed. And second of all, it would kind of, as the snow melted, it would kind of pull them down and water it and keep it. Do you know what I mean? It was like a perfect
Right, they settle.
germinating situation.
Right, they settle into the little nooks and crannies. It makes so much sense, but also on the other hand, it makes no sense at all.
Right, it's not necessary,
Right,
but it
because
was, a thing for so
poppies
long.
grow in Afghanistan, or it doesn't snow, and they germinate
Right.
at 90 degrees. They'll start germinating at 70 degrees, but not below that. So there's no, they don't need stratification. I see this all the time, and a
Right, they
lot.
don't need a cold treatment,
They don't need a
right.
cold treatment, so but also it doesn't harm them, so there's
Right.
nothing wrong with it. So we, I think if it works for you, go for it. It doesn't work for me here. I have a, like you probably have a very crowded garden. It's plant heavy.
Nah, I don't have any
No,
plants. No.
yeah, I
Mm-mm,
know.
no.
I've seen pictures,
Yeah.
but they, I know people in Connecticut where they self-sow every year, or New Jersey. That's terrific, but here in. Get a little farther north, and if they germinate in the fall, they don't survive the winter. So it's those ones that survive through the spring that germinate. And the outside, yeah, they'll germinate at the right time. It's going to be 70 degrees on some March day for 2 or 3 days, and they germinate, and that's perfect for them. Which does bring up the whole winter sowing thing, like winter sowing in jugs. That is definitely something that drives me crazy.
It drives you crazy, but it's this sort of new version. Again, speaking of like you and I more have the nostalgic ritual version, which is we like the old fashioned sort of sowing in, community pots or in flats under some kind of hardware cloth or whatever, or wire protection to keep the rodents out, leaving the flat out, in some kind of a cold frame or whatever, uncovered, let the
Right,
winter
right.
do its thing. We like the old fashioned method,
That's the
but
old
now
fashioned
there's the
way.
modern method. So, and it
Well,
works,
it
but
works.
it doesn't please me visually or physically. I don't, the touch of it, the materials, they don't please me in the way the
Yeah.
other does. Yeah.
No, I think what I'm seeing with the milk carton, this whole cold season started, people are starting plants that don't need to be started that way or
Right,
absolutely
right,
should not.
right,
Like
right,
poppies, for instance, that things
right.
that don't want root disturbance. I mean, it is something that real serious gardeners did since, the year 1900 with alpine plants or some perennials that require that a real cold period to stratify the seed. But it's not, the list is not as long as people think. And when I go through the list of what people are starting in their jugs, it's often like Rudbeckia, Pycnanthemum, or Echinacea, or Lobelia cardinalis, and Spirobolus grasses. All these germinate without any cold stratification, so there's no need to be sowing these in January.
Right. And I always say to people, do the homework, read about the plants and find out about whether they need it first.
Exactly.
So that, match the right plant to the right tactic.
Right.
Even with after I read your Instagram post a couple weeks ago, whenever it was, I was, I had been that morning watering my house plants, and it was past mid-January. We were getting a few minutes of, additional light here and there. The days were lengthening a teeny bit. You're starting to feel it a little bit. It's not quite so dire as the December and early January darkness and so forth. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, how many different ways I've tried to time when I'm supposed to, do the right thing by the plants in terms of when am I supposed to start fertilizing them again? And, when is it okay to, that sort of, and it used to be, well, it used to be they could go from fall until, I don't know, I think late winter practically, we didn't feed, or sometimes people said, well, once there was a certain amount of day length, you started feeding again. But like, what's the trigger? What do I believe is the right thing? Is there a right thing, or is it just use my judgment and what's my best judgment? When do you like when do you, when's your houseplant feeding season, for instance? I mean, do you have a time when you start again, or do you do it all year long,
I'm not really good at my houseplant feeding, I'll admit. However, I am a bit of a geek about feeding other plants, whether it's vegetables or I have a greenhouse too, so
Right.
I don't fertilize the greenhouse at all in the winter, except the cold growing plants, which would be my species cyclamen and it's kind of Neroni cardinalis and I'm sorry, Neroni. And some of the amaryllis, some of the winter growing bulbs, they're dormant in the summer. So the winter is their natural growing season.
Right.
But indoors, I suppose the right way to do it indoors would, because its temperature really affects how plants take up nutrients. And often that 70 degree point for nitrogen and whatnot, they can't access a lot of nutrients when it's colder than 70. So I would think indoors, the right way to do it would be, a 10% fertilizer solution every time you water or something like that. That's what commercial greenhouses do. They drop in a few drops, whether it's
Right.
organic or inorganic.
Right. Weekly.
We it is
W-E-A-K.
yeah. The big issues with plants
A-K-O.
and health is, if you think of it like our health, it's pH of the soil. There's electrical conductivity that happens in the soils. You need to make sure the pH is right for that plant, for that soil. And then allows the plant to take up certain nutrients. It's why plants look so beautiful when they're grown, professionally in a greenhouse somewhere. They're monitoring that all the time. And at home, of course, we just don't do that. So the smart way is to sort of repot annually into a fresh soil, whether it's a compost mix or, a good potting mix that's right for that plant, because some plants want acidic soil, some don't. And then fertilizing on a schedule. So it requires a lot of research. And from researching,
Right.
it's so hard to weed through the conflicting, because everything conflicts.
Exactly. That's what I meant. So I was like thinking, oh, I remember the when I sort of settled on the once the days start to get a little bit longer and you start to almost see the plants perk up as if they notice,
Yeah,
then I
they are.
start feeding again. And that was one of the nostalgic rituals that I actually like because I sort of can understand it in the same way that I feel a little better with more light, you know what I mean? In the less dark,
Yeah.
less short days. Anyway.
It's common sense, like
Exactly,
camellias are blooming
exactly.
now in the greenhouse. But once the flowers stop on the camellias, the new growth starts. And I know that's when they need nitrogen, because nitrogen would be for foliar growth. And that's only like one shoot, like a rhododendron, like it just gets one growth spurt and those leaves mature. And I have to make sure I give nitrogen then. But when they're forming their buds, then I'm giving a more rounded feed.
Right. So I want to make sure, just so that we don't use up all our time, I want to make sure that do you have some other ones that have been, sort of like you want to tell us a couple of other ones that you've noticed have been different? I mean, for instance, like I in terms of now versus then practices, the ones that are informed by science, I feel like these days we have so much better understanding scientifically of how things work, especially with the greater ecology. And so for things like the leaves, like being a little less fussy about our cleanup,
Oh, yeah.
those are really important changes to make, I think, and I wouldn't want to be nostalgic about that because I think the greater good, you know, there's so much diversity supporting, you know, it's so important, that effort. So that's where I definitely want to be open and not stuck to my obsessive cleaning up. I mean, I still do clean up certain areas where I have tiny little ephemeral spring things or minor bulbs, you know,
right.
little areas. I make sure they're not under 6 inches of leaves or whatever. But yeah, but other ones that, you know, you sort of have then and now thing?
Well, the cleaning up the garden thing, and we never cleaned up our garden anyway, so I have to be, I suppose that now we've come around full circle, but there are some things we do clean up, like bearded iris, things you have to pull the foliage off because borers will, you know, lay their eggs in the foliage in the fall. Vegetable gardens, I still clean up all the foliage because you have cabbage root
yes.
fly maggots and that lay their eggs. So the flower gardens, the perennial borders, I don't touch. You know, they're in full seed heads now still, and the grasses and all that. But where we grow our food, that I do clean out because whether it's a brassica or a tomato crop, you know, there are a lot of pathogens that live in the stems of these plants. And those
or
are,
in any debris you leave of, you know,
yeah.
squash or, as you say, brassicas.
And in the greenhouse too,
right.
because that's like a closed
right.
environment. So I don't use any insecticides in my greenhouse unless I absolutely have to. But it's a cold greenhouse, so we don't really get any insect damage when it's 40 degrees in there.
Right.
But
so you've stuck to the sort of thorough cleanup of the edible crops where there may be overwintering pests
yeah.
or pathogens. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's probably where the biggest science research is right now. Let's say I always like to respond when I see people say I'm planting my cold weather crops in the spring because that's changed. You know, like broccoli and brassicas, we used to think, oh, I'm going to sow my broccoli outdoors in March or, you know, early, and which my parents even used to do. And now that science has changed, especially in the north, because if you have cabbage root fly maggot or club root or any of these, you know, pathogens that live in the soil, you can navigate around those by changing your planting dates. So this is great information you can get from like the University of Massachusetts, their agricultural pages, where you can see, you know, recommendations made to commercial growers, like farmers who are growing acres and acres and acres of broccoli, to sow seed closer to the summer solstice to
yes.
make that first hatch, even though there are 7 hatches a year or whatever of certain insects. But you can navigate around that. So we're because we're more organic now or more aware, we can time planting. So, and brassicas don't want to germinate when it's cold anyways. They are not really a cold weather crop. You know, cabbages and broccoli and Brussels sprouts are better sown in June and grown as a fall crop.
Right, right.
Same thing with zinnias and cosmos and anything from Central America. And, you know, there's no need to start those early. You know, sowing in mid-June, you're going to get, flower farmers know this, they sow every 2 or 3 weeks, but they don't sow anything that early.
Yeah. I mean, I think especially now as we see the impact of the changing climate, that's the other thing, is that I feel like I'm going to be adjusting some of my, what used to be my rituals, you know, I knew time-wise in my head.
Yeah, more fall crops.
Right? I mean, because,
right?
you know, right now, if you do some of these spring things a little too late, they're going to bump into some intense heat like we had last year, and even in the north,
right?
Right? So I may want to back up even farther early in the spring, or as you say, wait till later and do it as a fall crop. And with the heat loving things, you know, the tomatoes or whatever, maybe we can go a little earlier and they can be set out a little earlier and the harvest is going to come sooner and so forth. So, you know, it's adjusting and listening and paying attention.
It is.
I guess.
And
yeah.
We're learning to sow later for some things. I just saw that trend of, we did this at an estate I used to work at where we'd sow tomatoes in June, the seeds in the ground.
Right.
We'll get tomatoes. And this year I saw Burpees is selling direct sow tomatoes and peppers.
Oh my.
Yeah. So that I'm going to experiment with that again. I think that's interesting. I mean,
interesting.
For my soul, I'm still sowing tomatoes right now, even though it's way early just because I have a greenhouse, but you know, they'll be too big to set out, but I need to smell those tomato leaves in February.
I know.
Oh, no one needs to know.
So in the last like 2 minutes or so, what is there another one? Do you just want to list one more or something that you've?
Yeah, there's a few little things.
Yeah.
Like these are what I'm like looking at and I want to experiment this year. Like in the UK, you see people posting, like Sarah Raven, like really well-known gardeners in the UK posting that I'm sowing my cobaya seeds, cup and saucer vine, now, early in January, if not December, because if you've ever grown it, you know it blooms late, like October or just before. And they say they bloom earlier. And I've been trying to find research on this. Now, I know it's an invasive plant in like the Southwest, where it grows wild, and it's a perennial, so it grows a long time for a year or two or three, a short-lived perennial. But I'm wondering why. I believe it blooms, by the day shortening day length of fall, but I can't find any data of that. But I did discover that it was grown as a greenhouse plant in New England as a winter blooming plant, which is interesting.
So
So I
that's one
wanted.
you're gonna look up and you
I'm going to
might
look
make a
it up
shift. Yeah.
because it seems like it needs to get a certain amount of pair of leaves before it will bloom. But it also won't bloom until the temperatures are changing and the day length is changing.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're gaining anything. And also things like they would sow the seeds vertically in the soil. That seems
Yeah.
to be like that doesn't really make a difference.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you, and as I said, I loved that post that you did, and the idea, that phrase you conjured of nostalgic rituals. So I've been thinking a lot about mine and which ones I'm going to keep holding on to,
That's
and
right.
which
Yeah.
ones I'm open to like easing a little bit. So thank you, and I hope I'll talk to you again soon, Matt. Thanks.
Thanks, Margaret. We'll see you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye bye. And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as at awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden provided by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, a third-generation bulb company offering top-size flower bulbs directly to landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at wholesale prices. On the web, colorblends.com. And by High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project verified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com. And by White Flower Farm, offering a wide range of carefully selected and expertly grown garden plants. On the web, whiteflowerfarm.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.